We have nothing before the court other than complaint. The complaint did not make any of the allegations that have been referred to. For example, the contention that you see in the brief, briefly respond to and heard stated again this morning, that there are no residents of the guest. That is premised, supposedly, on a reference to maps. Those maps were not attached to the complaint. They were not before the trial court. They are not properly before this court. They were merely offered as an exhibit to a brief in the court of appeal. There was no motion to supplement the record.
If they had, would it have made any difference?
If it had, it should not make a difference as a matter of law, Your Honor. I will tell you, since it seems to be now the fashion, that there are residents in the guest, but we do not believe that that is a permanent effect of the case. The examples that were given to Justice Lundberg's press on taxes and the one that she gave back about the hotel tax are good ones. Contrary to the response that you received, Justice Press, the fact is that when the working and residents work in the city of Boston and are obliged to pay on the city income tax, the first 1% of that tax was not voted. It was never voted, and that's the case in most municipalities in the state.
It was imposed by council.
It was imposed by a body, a political body, over which those non-resident taxpayers had no voting choice.
But for which there was the right of preference.
Not by those taxpayers, Your Honor.
No, but by the taxpayers of the tax district.
There's only a referendum, and this is important, I think, for this court, not only for purposes of this case, perhaps for the matters that may come before you, to remember that there's no constitutional right to referendum on any tax. The Constitution provides for referendum rights on other kinds of legislative measures, but not on tax. The only time when there is a referendum right on tax is where the referendum has been specially provided by the General Assembly in legislation. That is purely a political choice that legislators are entitled to make as to whether they will or will not create the right of referendum, or, in some instances, what would be effectively an advance referendum, a vote by the people as to whether to adopt the tax. Neither a vote before or after a tax is constitutionally required.
Is that true of city charters? Can't the city charter say any action of the city council is subject to referendum?
Absolutely.
And that's what...
If it is adopted as a provision of the city charter, I'm talking as a constitutional proposition, there is no obligation that the city charter have that provision. And there is no obligation that appears in the Constitution that there be a right of referendum without it being adopted in the form, for example, of the city charter.
Are there examples of other tax guys who are that the state local tax can be imposed by a body that was not elected? And that is not subject to the voter's challenge
at all? The answer to that is yes. There are special local tax districts where the legislation provides for taxes to be imposed by an appointed board. And those people are only subject to political will indirectly. That is, ultimately, everyone is appointed by someone who is responsible for someone who is ultimately elected.
What would you say?
I cannot point you to a specific one, but by way of example, there are, if I understand it, some joint hospital agreements, visitor sanitation agreements, where there is a power to impose tax that has been vested in the board. There, the issue that came before this court,
that tax is not a trustee or something.
That's right. There, the issue that came before this court was whether or not it was further question that came before this court was whether or not it was proper for an elected official of one jurisdiction to also serve as an appointed official of another jurisdiction. And this court again said yes, and that person must remember which hat is on when acting on behalf of a particular district, and to have a fiduciary duty for the district in which that person is acting.
I think that there's not been a prior challenge of a tax imposed by such a authority.
I am not aware of it. There are, however, as you can see, once you allow special tax districts, which are now 25 or 80 years old, state of Ohio, and are prolific, we have them on all varieties all across the state. Everything from mental health boards, transportation.
Which is all about, there's all about a pocket post to post
that. Some do and some do not. It just depends on the authorizing legislation. Again, I emphasize the question of the vote is not mandated by the Constitution. That is purely a political question as to whether the General Assembly decides that they are willing to take the heat of having that. Having been voted, or whether the General Assembly says we are simply going to tell people that we have made something available that the local voters will make the decision. There are plenty of these districts where the principal problem, as I understand it, that the appellant addressed can be determined. Namely, districts where people living outside the district are benefited by the district, even though they are not taxpayers within the district. For example, joint hospital districts. There are no joint hospital districts that do, nor do I think it's a matter of law, could they confine the provision of hospital services to taxpayers. People who live a mile across the line from the hospital district may very well go and obtain medical services at that hospital. Similarly, as Justice Cook knows, in the Akron area, for many years, a suburb that adjoined the city of Akron had been the beneficiary of water purchases from the city of Akron. Those are people who are greatly benefited by the fact that over a period now of almost 100 years, the city of Akron has invested enormous funds in building a water system and never taxed those people lying in the outlying suburbs, even though those people now purchase water. It's also important to realize that the argument that's being made, namely that the residents of the township outside of the shed are getting the, quote, same benefits as those within the shed, that argument is incorrect. Namely, while they get access to sewer and water services, persons living in the township outside of the shed pay higher fees for sewer and water services than do those people located within the shed. Moreover, within the shed, they get such things as food service, and people living in the township outside the shed do not get it. The fact of the matter is that the attack that has been made on this statute really, it has no precedent in Ohio law. It has been now at least 70 years where the ability of the General Assembly to delegate a taxing power consistent with a legislatively stated objective has been upheld repeatedly by this court. It happens every day. The fact that it is an income tax of no constitutional whatsoever. If it were a property tax, presumably we wouldn't be having this kind of a tax because the plaintiffs here are income taxpayers and are not even alleged to be property owners. The problem that we have with all of the arguments is that these are arguments that are being made that purport to assert the rights of voters. And none of the appellants are electors of any is an equivalent of a local option statute. And if you would find that local option statutes are unconstitutional unless they are simultaneously chosen by every potentially available chooser, that would upset an enormous amount of local government in this state. There is no constitutional requirement that is impaired by making local options any elective, which is some county, and then within it certain subdivisions have chosen. In terms of the two other constitutional challenges, I move that on proposition of law number 3, that is the equal protection argument, that there is no constitutional substance that requires or approved by a vote of any taxpayer, including those either in or outside AGS. The board here adopted the tax, and the board can change the tax. That is the essence of the equal protection issue. What the opponents don't like, quite simply, is that they find themselves investing there is only the upward limitation that was imposed by legislation, that they have ceilings, they cannot exceed the level of taxation imposed by a municipality, which is a contracting party, which has. So, but they can go down.
Can they, can the district decide who's going to define income differently?
I believe not, because I believe the legislation tells them what they are entitled to tax, and then they can be left to do it. When it comes to the fourth and last proposition of law, the denial of due process, the basic showing that's required by the appellants is that there was arbitrary and irrational action. The question is not, as suggested, whether there are other ways that could be chosen to reach the same goal. There certainly are. There are many other ways to, for example, run schools in the state of Ohio than those that have been chosen. It does not mean that there is only one right answer to economic development. Rather, the question is the use of the Joint Economic Development District pooling the resources of two adjoining political subdivisions a way that can achieve economic development? We suggest to you that it is like to drive up in 1977 and look at the goal that it makes.
Does a tax levy imposed in the JED enjoy the same protection as a tax levy enacted by the General Assembly, which has protection under Article 2, Section 1D, that it shall not be subject to referendum? Does the JED tax levy have that same protection?
Yes.
So it's by virtue of what? Vicariousness?
By virtue of general law. The only way that it would not have that protection is if the General Assembly, in the authorizing legislation, provided that there would be periodic referenda or the referendum is available. There's nothing that would prevent the General Assembly, in authorizing the tax to be a vote, to have required a vote.
Yes. But if they do not, it is your contention if they do not, if they just authorize the levying of a tax, and the tax is levied, it enjoys the same constitutional protection as if it were done by the General Assembly itself. Is there authority for that?
I believe that is in fact, I don't have a case for you, Your Honor, but I believe that is in fact
the only thing that changes that are charters. Maybe that's what's clouding my mind.
The charter where you have essentially replaced the power of the General Assembly because of home rule.
I understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobs. Deserves you use your time for 30 seconds.
Thank you, sir. At the point of clarification, pursuant to the judge contract, the city during the term of the contract created a tax rate. By the guest contract, income tax in the guest automatically. That happens with the house of necessity, the guest were approving that, or the electors voting on that issue. That's another example of how people who are affected by the tax have some input in the decision to propose the tax earlier on.
You still have another 30 seconds, so I'm curious about this. What injury does your client suffer?
Your Honor, as an example, the client who is situated in Cobb's district, that client for this statute was enacted already had water and sewer in the town. By paying the 2% income tax, the consideration they would get was extension of water line through the city to their business. There is no consideration. They already have the water.
That's not an injury. That's lack of a benefit. What injury does your client suffer? The tax that's being paid,
correct,
obviously, is the tax that's deductible.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so what harm, and don't we usually look in these cases for standing and otherwise, what harm does your client suffer?
Well, by the payment of the income tax, Your Honor, that completes the businesses of operating capital. That resolves economic loss to the client. So we believe that the harm in this case is economic. In addition, the reciprocal agreements first were at issue here, and now I understand how those debt taxes are being addressed by the realm itself.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The appeal of 98.206 has been dismissed. The next case is 98.1793. District Council versus Thomas Brown.
I believe that the appropriate place to start this matter is really not with this particular case, case 98-73, which also involves Mr. Brown. He came up to this court on default, and in response to the motion we filed to remand that for hearing, this court, on December the 8th, just 1 week ago today, granted the motion and remanded that matter back to the Board of Commissioners on Grievance Discipline for evidentiary hearing.
Should these matters be combined and sent back to the board?
That is what our request is, Your Honor, and quite candidly, our plea and our objection was a similar plea to that which we asked for the motion to remand, which was remand back to the board for an evidentiary hearing.
But didn't we in one of these issue a discipline, a public reprimand? But we did. That was just the recommendation.
The recommendation in 1973 was the public reprimand, Your Honor. And that was a matter that was remanded back and forth a week ago. The recommendation here was for an indefinite suspension. However, that was very heavily predicated upon 98-73. So the predicate, we believe, is not there at this point.
And what did we do? We remanded it back to the board for a full
trial. And that's what we're asking.
Which means what? It goes before the three-person panel again?
Generally correct. We're going before the three-person panel, and quite frankly, we have no problem. In fact, later on in our presentation, I suggest that the judicial economy would combine the matter on one hand.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You consolidate the two and let it go forward on one issue.
That's what we're requesting.
One case.
And the other was presented.
Let me just ask you, isn't that... It already takes a long time for these cases to get to us and for us to decide what sanction, if any, to impose on lawyers who violated the code. It seems to me there's a fair amount of medical or psychiatric evidence here indicating that Mr. Brown really isn't very capable of practicing law. My concern, I guess, about fact, he continues to practice when we've got evidence that indicates that his deficiencies are quite severe. I guess I'm concerned about clients believing that it's all right to be represented by him when we have a lot of evidence to think that that's not really the case. Is that...
Your Honor, my understanding of the evidence is that he's being treated and obviously being appropriately treated and is not supposed to be the court observer appropriately concerned about it. I believe that a number of the problems the court is appropriately concerned about were present without the appropriate treatment. Also, during a period of time before Mr. Brown availed himself to the auto assistance program, because the use of alcohol exacerbated the problems that he had.
Well, is the observation of Dr. Gillette that he's exhibited markedly diminished interest in normal activities today, including occupational tasks, inability to think or concentrate, psychomotor retardation, loss of energy, inordinate void of support, family, and business affairs, is that current or is that something that's no longer
current? That was present before the treatment, before he was undergoing treatment and has improved. That would be the type of thing we would like to have the opportunity to have to come back. It's unfortunate. I really wish that I was in a position to account for this inventory of practice.
Franklin, Nebraska.
Thank you, Mayor. Please record. Our later position in this case is that case number 98-1793 should not be remanded to the Board of Commissioners. As you know, in the other case that Mr. Coleman referred to, 98-783, I believe it is, we filed a response in opposition to the motion for remand. The Board of Commissioners report in that case was filed with this court on April 22nd. It was not until October that counsel became involved in this case and he filed a motion to remand that to the Board of Commissioners. The reason that we oppose that remand and the reasons that we believe this particular case should not be remanded are for reasons that are raised by Mr. Brown himself and reasons that are not raised. First of all, there is no denial of due process here, and there is not even an argument that he was denied due process. Makes this case very different from the Jackson case, in which it was remanded to the board because Mr. Jackson was in fact denied due process. Mr. Brown has not denied the allegations, either in the previous complaint in which public reprimand is recommended or in the current complaint in which an indefinite suspension is recommended. The only assurance we have in this case is Mr. Brown's personal assurance that he has in fact been treated for his mental illness. But we don't know what treated means in this case. Chief Justice Moyer, yes, but I would assume, Justice Stratton, that in objections which are filed, in addition to claiming mental illness, I would have imagined there would be some response to the fact. There's no response to the fact at all in this case. If the relator is completely off base with its allegations, with its facts, in the case that has resulted in recommended discipline, then I would have assumed there would have been some sort of response to that. There has been no response.
Your whole argument is this is the place to respond to that because you make your whole case on the remand on the matter of no-doubt to the fact in the first place. It seems to me that if they didn't have any facts to dispute, why would they bother going to the trial?
Certainly, I totally understand that. I'm just saying that that's one factor that should be considered. If the brief had perhaps addressed the fact that Ken had denied that would be considered as well. But in this case, I'm just suggesting that they deny and address the fact as another factor that should be considered by this court. Chief Justice Moyer raised the issue of whether the psychological evaluations that are attached here are current. They're in fact dated September 30th, which was, I believe, 8 days before this was filed. I don't believe it's going to be more current than that. Both of these professionals have said that essentially they're not really sure what this man's status is. In fact, the closing paragraph of Dr. McGee's letter says that his depression may have contributed to his poor judgment during the last 2 years at least. Our position in this case is that, quite frankly, he should be suspended at this point based on his self-admitted mental illness. Allow him to rehabilitate himself, and then readmit him to the pressures of law. This is sort of counsel entering this case has clearly entered here at the 11th hour. His first disciplinary action has been pending before this court since last April. The second disciplinary action was filed by the board in September, recommending an indefinite suspension. Once respondent got word that he was perhaps going to get indefinitely suspended, he got counsel, and we now hear that he is mentally ill. But it was not until that point. I think also that his argument of mental illness is very definitely a double-edged sword. He's sick enough to get back to a hearing before the board, but he's not sick enough to stop practicing law. I'm afraid I don't really understand that argument. Our position is that he should not be permitted to practice until he can now justify that he is in fact fit to practice, that he has undergone treatment, the treatment is effective, and that can be proven during the reinstatement hearing if he is indefinitely suspended. He has allegedly been in treatment since 1996, since June of 1996, but both of related cases have been pending since June of 1996. I'm sorry, the first case was pending then, the second case hasn't been pending that long. So we have two default ones. So I sort of wonder about the success of this treatment. We're not making this argument in this case because we think that sending this particular case back to the board sets a bad precedent. That's not our argument. Our argument is very much focused on the fact of this particular case. Mr. Brown appears in court daily. He takes two clients daily. Now, you have someone who is admittedly mentally ill. Our position is that he should not be practicing law. This case can stand on its own. Even if the previous case, 98783, is in fact remanded, even if that order is not rescinded, he could still be indefinitely suspended based on the facts of 98793. Based on the response, based on the objections, we believe the facts justify an indefinite suspension and that, in fact, he should be suspended from the practice of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. The equivalent, you say 7 minutes.
I would just like to reference something. While we didn't brief this area, the charges contained in the incident that was R1 symbol of neglect of this defilement. Now, I'm not saying that's okay, but I'm also saying that it's not the kind of matter that generally would call this court to even think about an indefinite suspension. In fact, in a normal situation where a deadline like that exists, it may not be charged, but it were, and you know, it does probably call the public government, had there been no previous system. The exacerbating factor in that, of course, would be the default, which is why we're in the first place. But I think to look at this and say that this matter, standing on some merit, to call for indefinite suspension, I don't believe really takes into account the body of law that's been created before the time of the court. Just on the spread, you actually made the point that I was going to make in response. We, in doing the objections, we believe, maybe wrongly, that we were restricted simply to reference to this point. We didn't feel that we were able to start raising or imposing factual defenses to various things. However, if you read the board's decision, you can see that even in the default, they talked in terms of defense. And they did that in 1973. So I believe that in order to fully and fairly process him and adjudicate him, that an evidentiary hearing is needed, and we are simply asking this on the court to remain in the case back to the board for that.
But the problem I have is, maybe it's touched on by Ms. Brown, that he's practicing law, he appears in court, and yet he's also has some defaults. He obviously hasn't represented his clients well. How do we, he's got a mental illness. I guess my question, why do we send that back for evidentiary hearing? It seems that he would have, if he represents clients in court, he's able to respond to a notice from district counsel, from the district system, is he not?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that part of the system, as I'm not a psychiatrist, but I believe that part of the problem with this would deal with the denial situation of being confronted with the disciplinary counsel and the charges that were levied in those particular matters. I don't mean it's right. But I believe that sometimes you can react to other people who are demanding yourself. And that was part of the symptomology, I believe, from suffering. And that part of the symptoms that get so forth and before. I think that your questions, quite frankly, are very, very relevant. I think they should be poured into, but I think we need a deep arena, so to speak, of an objection to hearing in order to get to those answers. Rather than just sit here and say, well, we think that you must have the confidence, therefore, we want to defend. I would just like to have the opportunity to present that
Well, in view of the evidence that we do have, the two quite current reports from doctors and the other evidence we have, would it be appropriate that if we remand it, that we suspend him while it's remanded?
Your Honor, I don't know that that would be appropriate. We certainly have to ask the court to do that. The court, we still choose options for having the power to do it in our suspension. The only thing that troubles me about that is that this court is not our made a remand order in last week.
That was a public reprimand, I think, wasn't it?
Well, but and this is only...
Now you have more. But we have more now. I imagine, you know, we're looking at it from the standpoint of protecting people who use lawyers. And we have evidence before us that he has some incompetency to do that well. Now, we're faced with the... He wants a second chance. He wants us to say, oh, you got to default it. That's okay. We're going to let you go back, present your evidence, which we don't usually do. And it seems to me that there has to be some balance here. If we do that, it seems to me, if we're giving him that benefit that we don't normally give, he represents clients in court, and yet he can't respond to the discipline system. He's in default. He's sort of on the mercy of the court now to do something extraordinary. It would seem to me that it would be in our interest professionally to say to him, okay, you can have another hearing, you can present your evidence, but we're not going to let you, we're not going to take the risk to let you practice law during that period of time. How is that unfair to him?
Your Honor, I'm not saying he's unfair. I'm just saying that our opinions differ. And I believe that it's a legitimate difference of opinion. As I indicated before, I believe the court has that power. If I were sitting in the court's chair, I don't believe I would take that position. That doesn't necessarily mean it's not fair. It just means that's not the way I would use it.
Is that because you think that the medical, the letters from the psychiatrist don't indicate that there's that much of a problem or that we need to worry about, or what? I'm trying to see where you and I can, where we're missing on the track.
Well, I suppose, Your Honor, partly this is because I have not seen any indication from the officials of the court or attorneys who are the county area. This problem going on at this point.
But that's, how do we, you know, we don't have monitors out in Amityville County talking all the time. So we have some evidence that he certainly has not represented clients well, not responded to this one system. How much do we have to? It may be that he's in recovery. Maybe that he's perfectly able to practice, and we'll find that out in a hearing if there's a hearing. We're not sure of that, are we? I mean, we aren't sure of that.
I understand that, Your Honor. That's the reason it's because I suppose we're all coming back in a circle. That's the reason why they went through here, so he can't. I don't know any other way to respond. Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We have one additional matter on our calendar. That's Systemary Council versus